Hello, I'm John Kelly, and this is a podcast of Mystery Train. For rights reasons, the music is shorter than in the original programme. Mystery Train hits the rails Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on RTE Lyric FM.
I'll sit you down and I will fill your can. And along the street, all the friends I meet say, there goes Muldoon, he's a solid man.
And that's the song called Muldoon, a solid man, by way of introduction to tonight's guest on Mystery Train. Picking all the music tonight, I'm delighted to say, is Paul Muldoon. Paul, great to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a thrill to be here.
I'm just amazed we can get you for this length of time. You are the hardest working man in show business by a long way.
I doubt it very much. I think that's Mick Baloney who just sang that wonderful song, which was a song, of course, that I heard mention of when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And to be called the Solid Muldoon was novel for me, actually. There were so many other things that I was called. Spotty Muldoon, of course, being one of them. But that's a fabulous song. It was written by Willie John Ashcroft. And, of course, it comes from the music hall tradition. And a song about an immigrant. I control the tombs, yeah. I control the island, a political fixer in New York and New Jersey, and what I'd hoped to be when I grew up myself.
Well, to an
but
extent,
it never quite worked out for
to
me.
To an extent, you are. You're living there now. I mean, that's an extraordinary thing, really, when you think about it. We maybe get to New York in a bit, but let's. This is the part you've done at the beginning of all your interviews. Although I'm kind of interested because, you know, what... It's not so often I see it said that you were born in Portadown. I usually get Armagh, then it jumps to the Moy, and then there's this strange kind of Armagh-Tyrone kind of mixture of territory.
Well, somebody has to be born in Portadown.
I suppose so.
And Portadown was the... Actually, Portadown's a great town. Portadown was the home, as it were, of the Carlton home, which in 1951, when I was born... My mother went there to give birth because it was felt that was the coming thing. Giving birth at home was kind of passé, and one needed to go somewhere to give birth, you know, in modern surroundings.
The doctor didn't come with the bag.
That's right. Yeah. And so that's why I was born in Portadown. But my people, at least most immediately, were from... Tyrone. You know, our particular branch of the Muldoons are up from round Kesh. That's the barony of Lurg. That's mm-hmm. where most of those Muldoons are from, certainly in the north.
And that's getting close to my territory.
It is.
Where there are still Muldoons.
That's where they're from. And they lived around there. They were thrown out of there a few hundred years ago by the Maguires. But, you know, we still like the Maguires. But that's our history, basically.
And what about Eglish, then, which is Tyrone?
Eglish was a place where we lived briefly. Eglish, my father ran a little shop there. My mother was a schoolmistress. And then we moved on to College Lands in North Armagh. And that's mostly where I was brought up.
When I first was reading your poetry, Paul, I thought the Moy somehow was a made-up mystical invention of a place, you know, like Thomas Hardy would invent somewhere. So is the Moy, is it a place? Is it a village? Is it a townland? Is it what?
Well, you know, the Moy's, the name, of course, still is a hangover of the Gaelic name An Mach, An Ma, the plain. And so the definite article is still lurking about it there. There are a few place names around the country that have that. The Rock, the Loop, the Moy. It was designed, actually, by James Caulfield, who was the Earl of Charlemont, who'd been on a grand tour of Europe as a young man and had come across the town of Marengo in Italy and supposedly designed the Moy Square on the basis of that Italian Plaza, and it's actually a very tidy wee town, and a beautiful town. I was in it the other day, and so it was best known as the site of a horse fair, one of the big horse fairs in Ireland, and that's basically what happened there. So when I started to write, of course, as a teenager, I started to write, as most people do, about the things that, you know, were immediately to hand, you know, including the Moy, where I was brought up, and then the more immediate area, the apple-growing area, where I was brought up.
Well, your first musical choice is very definitely Armagh. We're in Katie with the Makeham family. You, I'm just wondering, because you later work in the BBC, and I'm thinking of David Hammond and his film of Sarah Makeham and all of that. You probably knew Tommy and all the rest of them, but you probably didn't know Sarah, did you?
You know what? I had the great pleasure of meeting Sarah Makeham.
Really? Yeah.
And actually going with Michael Longley, who was presenting a radio programme for me that I was producing at the time when I worked for the BBC. And we went to interview her, and she sang for us. And, you know, what I love about her is just the... It's what Davy Hammond used to refer to himself as the raw bar. Mm. You know, it's just, it's the genuine article. It's maybe even the definite article.
Sarah Makeham, As I Roved Out.
As I roved out on a May morning right early, I met my love upon the way, oh Lord, but she was early. Rolling eye and her earrings tipped her shoulders. And she sung little doodle, little doodle, little doodle day, and she hid land the day, and she hid land the day, and she landed.
As I roved out from Sarah Makeham, the choice of Paul Muldoon, who's with me in studio tonight. Paul Muldoon, poet, musician, librettist, Armagh man, all sorts of things. Former poetry editor of The New Yorker as well. You've heard me talking a few times about their podcast. And the ones that Paul does are still there, so I highly recommend you maybe talk about that in a moment, Paul. But we'll stay back where we are. When you went to school, in Armagh, right? Obviously not initially, but the big school you went to was St. Patrick's.
The big school was St. Patrick's College, Armagh. And big school was what it was. I mean, the quality of the teaching there was quite remarkable. By any standards, and you know, there were great people teaching math, great people teaching physics and chemistry, and great people teaching English literature and Irish. And one of the people who taught me Irish was Jerry Hicks, and Jerry Hicks was an extraordinary teacher. His way of teaching was reading aloud. It sounds kind of corny. I don't think it's much done this year. And he had us reading aloud too. So that, for example, when we came to study King Lear, he had, you know, you'd be Cordelia and you'd be Goneril. And you just set out and you'd play King Lear. You'd act up and act out King Lear in the classroom. Which means, of course, that to this day, you know, I know King Lear like actually better than the back of my hand in many ways. Couldn't start reciting it for you, but you know, when I go to see it or hear it or experience it, you know, very conscious of it. But Jerry, you know, had many strings in his bow. One of them was that he was a singer and a guitarist, indeed. And he was a scholar of folk song and of Irish folk song. He had done his graduate work at Queen's on some of the last Gaelic speakers in County Tyrone. And that, you know, sometime in the 1930s, I would say, maybe into the 40s, but I think the 30s. And, you know, this particular song that we're going to hear now is from a collection that he did called Cúlta Ulla, Songs of Ulster. A number of them had been collected, actually, by another of my teachers, Sean O'Boyle, Sean of Wale, great scholar of Irish. This particular one, of course, and Bun and Bwee, one of my very favourite poems. It is a poem slash song. And one of the things I learned from these guys, actually, was that, and something I continue to be very interested in, is the point at which poem and song are indistinguishable. He'll be singing it in Irish, as Gaeilge, but if you'll recall that fabulous translation by Thomas McDonagh, the yellow bitter that ne'er broke out in a drinking bout might as well have drunk. His bones are thrown on a naked stone where he lived alone like a hermit monk. And one and we shimmelain the lee is the chrawa shincha thresh the chan.
You do remember it.
Oh, one and we shimmelain the lee is the chrawa shincha yakalum is not yan to gene is a hini
and Bun and Bwee there from Jerry Hicks from an album called Cúilte Ola. And Paul Muldoon's with me in studio tonight picking the tracks. Paul, tell me a little bit more about the teachers and the education in that school, in St. Patrick's in Armagh. And the reason I say this is because on the face of it, Catholic Boys Grammar School, and if I could round up a lot of boys who went to Catholic Boys Grammar School, and they wouldn't have a whole lot of good things to say about school or their experience. And one of the things that unites people in those sorts of conversations is there seems to have been a lack of ambition. A kind of a mediocrity was certainly tolerated, if not encouraged at times. But every time you meet people who went to St. Patrick's in Armagh, they talk about Sean O'Boyle and they talk about Jerry Hicks, and they say that they had a whole different approach. They wanted the fellas to do well, and they sent them to places like Oxford. That seems quite rare to me in terms of the Catholic Boys Grammar School of the time.
You know, I think whatever the opposite of mediocrity might be, that was what obtained there. But I'm sure it obtained in many schools. But, you know, they were certainly keen to have us do as best we could, which doesn't mean that they were forcing stuff down our throats or anything like that at all. Not at all. It was just that the milieu, as they say, was just one of fostering and love. And, you know, I was taught French by a man called Bill O'Brien, for example. I was very into French poetry when I was a teenager. I had a teacher called John McCarter, who had been a tax inspector in Dublin, very connected to the Dublin literary scene.
I read this before. Is this the man who used to know Kavanagh?
Yes, he would have known Kavanagh. He knew the whole McDade's scene. Right. And he was coming back on a Monday morning, possibly slightly the worse for wear, after a weekend in Dublin. But he would be telling us, this was 1966 or 67, you know, there was this fellow called Paul Durkin, for example, who was quite good. And he can only have been he was only a kid. But what I'm trying to say is that there was a sense of being connected to a wider world, a world in which art, literature mattered. Sean O'Boyle encouraged us to translate poems from Irish, for example, and he sent them down to the Irish Press, who at that time ran the Aistrichán column. Yeah. And we were sitting there as kids in Armagh, seeing our poems appearing in the Irish Press. And that was big news, you know. And then Jerry Hicks himself, and in a story that's been told probably several times too often, introduced me to Seamus Heaney and Michael Longley and Davy Hammond on the one night in April 1968. And that was a momentous occasion too, I mean, in terms of being connected.
Was it at 68 you hadn't yet gone to Queen's?
No. I was 16 when I met Heaney and Longley, but I was scribbling away. You know, I was, You know, in the way that 16-year-olds know about whatever it might be, football, mm-hmm. or stamps, you know, or in the case of my own son, who's just turned 20, when he was 16, he was deeply, he was already a scholar of the musical. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I was kind of interested in the musical myself. And indeed, one of the things, apart from all this literature coming in and all the music we listen to, of course, on the radio, etc., Radio Éireann and the BBC, you know, we were also, I remember vividly going to see Oklahoma in Dungannon.
And was that anything to do with school? Because often you're forced into musicals at school and not necessarily...
Well, there were musicals at school. They did put on musicals, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. But in this case, I think it was just... I don't honestly remember what the connection was. I think it was just, you know, supposedly an interesting musical, which it certainly was, even in that production. As it turns out... there were family connections. Gordon McRae, who's going to be singing the Surrey with the fringe on top here, was actually someone for whom my first cousin, Marina McCall, from Scotstown in County Monaghan, had worked as a nanny.
Is that right?
That's right. And as it turns out, actually... one of my wife's relatives, Helene Hanf, had been working on the first production of Oklahoma. And she was there the night before it opened. They decided that Oklahoma was not actually the right name. It had been called something else, actually, in an earlier manifestation. Then they decided that they'd change it to Oklahoma. And in the middle of the night before it opened, I think, they decided that it needed a little extra je ne sais quoi. And that's how it became Oklahoma with an exclamation point.
That's all it takes. Very good.
I'll take you out tonight with me, John the Top.
Sorry, with the fringe on top. Gordon McRae there, the choice of Paul Muldoon, is with me in studio tonight. When you were a young fellow, Paul, you went to see that. Did you really buy into it? Because there would have been other music in your head at that moment in time. It might have been more, on the face of it, more attractive to a young fella.
Well, I mean, I was interested in all kinds of music. Ours was a strange house, I'm sure, in a number of ways. One of them being that we didn't have an LP collection or anything on which to play them. For some reason, that was something we didn't have. We did have a piano, and we all tried to learn the piano, and that didn't quite work out. And I remember my mother, for some reason, acquiring a tape recorder. Mm-hmm. And, you know, which was all kind of a strange thing to have in the house. But I think there was a tradition in both her family home and my father's home, in fact, I think, of it being a Kelly house. People would come round and sing songs and tell stories, recite poems. And, you know, our house was not quite that. But from time to time, neighbours would come in. And, you know, many of them were singers. And they would sing a song and we would record it on on the tape recorder. And you know, we would listen back to it. So, you know, Gordon McRae and the music of Oklahoma, you know, as far as I'm concerned, it's all one thing. It's all part of one continuum. And who knows? I mean, some of the structures of those songs, clearly there's much American music that, you know, harkens back to the structure of folk songs from Ireland and Scotland, obviously. And so it doesn't seem so strange to me that the that music theatre would have been part of my life, in the way that traditional music was, of course.
And in those parties in the house, Paul, did you have a party piece as a child or as a teenager? Did you have a turn that you would do?
You know, I did once enter, if that's the right term, the fesh in Dungannon.
Yeah.
And I must have, I did enter in the verse speaking section, I believe, and it was in English. And the poem I read was The Lake Isle of Inishfree,
yeah,
by W.B. And I can't even remember how I did in Dungannon. I don't know if I did all that. I don't really remember. But I did come back to College Lands Parish Hall, which was about the size of this studio. It's a building that's still standing. And somehow I was called upon to recite The Lake Isle of Inishfree. And I got up and I came to a point and I got stuck and I started going round. The record started sticking. And I have never actually got over it. And I still can't, with assurance or conviction, get up and read anything from memory. I have a terrible memory. And I think I was sort of put off just by that moment. And I do occasionally read The Lake Isle of Inishfree, but I can't read it with confidence. So anyway, that was my party piece. I wasn't very good at it, I think, you know.
And could you play a music? Could you sing, Paul? Did you?
You know,
I mean, I know you do now, but I'm wondering at what point you started.
Well, you know what? I think it's fair to say somebody introduced me a few nights ago as being a multi-instrumentalist. I am not actually a mono-instrumentalist. I am a guy who has been known to play a couple of chords on a guitar.
Yeah, but, you know, some very fine songs have been written with those couple of chords.
Well, my problem is, the chords I play on the guitar are never necessarily the right ones in the right place, in the right order. I don't know, I'm not good at it. I love writing lyrics. And
but when did you first get a guitar, Paul?
I'll tell you what I got. I didn't get a guitar, I got a banjo.
Right.
And I was very, very much in love with the Dubliners. And I was in love with every aspect of the Dubliners. You know, I loved Barney McKenna on the tenor banjo. And so I bought myself a tenor banjo and I tried to play it. And you know what? It's very hard. And I thought, you know what? Maybe the G banjo, which Luke Kelly played, is the way to go. And that also was quite hard. And I do remember quite vividly trying to play T-Rex Get It On.
On the banjo?
On the banjo. I'll tell you something about that. That doesn't work.
I would pay real money to hear that.
I would pay money to hear it too. I think, you know, above all, I was always interested for the larger part in the lyrics of songs. And even from the time I was a kid, I wanted to try to write lyrics.
Before writing, the idea of writing poems, the idea of writing songs might have been there first?
I think they existed coincidentally.
Mm.
I never really did much about it for years. But, I mean, when I was a kid, I was a big fan of Patrick Kavanagh. And of course, I was a fan of his poems. But I was also a fan of the poem that became a song. He wrote it, of course, to an already existing heir. But, I mean, in a strange way, even as a teenager and certainly in my 20s, the idea of one day being able to write something like Raglan Road was very appealing to me. And I might even have thought when I was a teenager that I might one day be able to do it. And of course, the only thing I know now as I near 70 is that It's highly unlikely. However easy this kind of thing looks, it's super difficult.
And was your motivation in wanting to do that at that age, was it solely for yourself, or was there some sense of creating something public? Because a song can be more public than a poem in many ways.
You know, I mean, I think maybe there was. I think there has to be, because, you know, I mean, people of my age, you know, at some level, I think we all harbored thoughts, if not ambitions, of being not rock stars exactly, because that's too much. I mean, we can't really expect that. That's too much to expect. But those were professions mm-hmm. that were to the fore as we were growing up. You know, it was clear that some people got to do that.
Yeah.
You know, just as some people got to be dentists.
Yeah. and this was more appealing. So Raglan Road is your choice. And now let me ask you this question. That's Raglan Road. It's such a well-known song now. Everybody knows it. And Luke's version of it is considered the version of it.
Yeah.
Did it ever lose any of its power for you through overuse or overhearing or oversinging?
Well, not for me. I mean, I could listen to it from one end of the day to the other, to tell you the truth. I mean, it's a great piece of writing. Kavanagh, you know, was formally, actually, it's one of his very best pieces. He's really great on the internal rhymes, a feature which certainly is dragged across and over and from the Irish tradition. And indeed, I mean, there is a theory, which I very happily go along with, that the use of rhyme in the Western tradition, you know, derives substantially from the Gaelic tradition. You know, and there may have been things that looked a bit like rhymes along the way, but it's really only with the Provençal poets that we begin to see rhymes in the Western tradition.
But run that by me again. You're talking about the entire Western tradition.
You know, there's a theory that the monks, of course, who were moving right through Europe, were alert to these poems that had been written down, many of them in the 9th century, though some of them dated from earlier. But internal rhyme is a feature of many of those poems. Mm-hmm. Rhyme itself is a feature of them. And that had really not been so much to the fore mm-hmm. prior to that. So I don't want to sound jingoistic about it, but, I mean, I think it's yet to be proven that rhyme does not begin with the Irish. I think it's something that we can hold on to until someone disproves it.
On Raglan Road of an autumn day, I saw her first. His wings at the dawn of day.
Luke Kelly there singing Raglan Road, the choice of Paul Muldoon, who's with me in studio tonight picking the music. Paul, I just want to come back to one thing you said a little bit earlier on. You talked about school and you used the words fostering and love. There was love in the school. You don't hear that very often.
Well, I think there was love, definitely. I mean, they were very encouraging.
Yeah.
And a bit of encouragement to a kid goes a very long way, you know. And, you know, they did things like give us books to read, you know, that weren't part of the official program.
Sure, sure.
So when I was 17, so 16 or 17, I probably knew more about poetry than I do now in some respect, because I thought I did, you know. And I had read 20th century poetry in English, American, UK, Irish. And I, you know, I'm sure it's like many musicians, you know, was steeped in this stuff.
Yeah.
That's how you get into it.
And
you know,
because of that, you know, you would have been better informed than the rest of us would have been at that age at school. When we were starting to write poetry, you know, the teacher would ask you to write, or you'd write something for the school magazine or something like that. And inevitably, we'd all wrote poems that were kind of like Seamus's poems, or trying to be, or like Ted Hughes or something, because we'd come across them in the curriculum, in the school book. What were you writing, though?
Well, I had a very similar situation, but what I was writing, most of the very first stuff I wrote was very Eliot-influenced.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you see, very few of us, I think at 17, had read Eliot.
Well, I knew a lot about Eliot when I was 17, and I went down to the Armagh County Museum, where there was a wonderful librarian, and she bought every book about T.S. Eliot. And not only had I read his poems, I'd read every book that I could get my hands on about him. I mean, I sort of knew too much in a strange way, and of course knew nothing.
Yeah.
You know, I sort of had read more about him and his poetry than I had. So there was that, and of course we were also reading the big guys at the time. They were guys for the most part: Hughes, Gunn, Larkin, were poets who were very much to the fore. You know, they were popular at the time. This was before Seamus Heaney really came to the fore. So those were the people I was influenced by, you know.
And in terms of popular culture at that time, when you were at school, I always thought, for instance, someone who's older than you, an older generation, someone like Seamus Heaney, for instance, Anne Montague, who was older again.
Yeah.
I don't think the Beatles meant anything to Seamus, you know.
You know, Stones. I think it's fair to say that they really didn't. You know, Seamus Heaney was born in 1939. He was 12 years older than myself. And 12 years is not a long time in the poetry generations, or indeed in any reckoning. But the truth is that something happened in the course of those 12 years that was very unexpected. It's not as if there hadn't been a tradition of popular music. There clearly was. but there was something about this particular manifestation of popular music that was really revolutionary.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just the Beatles, to name but one band, you know, it's no wonder that people were burning their records in the US. Now, the main reason why they were burning their piles of their records had to do with John Lennon making some perhaps ill-judged remark about their being bigger than Jesus, or maybe having the capacity of being bigger than Jesus. Which just went the wrong way. Yeah. And that was in an era, you can imagine what would happen nowadays with the so-called social media.
Yeah.
But anyway, you know, the fact is that, you know, the generation above us looked at how the Beatles were viewed, and all these screaming girls, as for the most part, not exclusively, young women, and they wondered, what on earth is going on here? And there was something new happening. There truly was. A song like Eleanor Rigby, for example, you know, Eleanor herself and the details of her life, they really are rather brilliantly set down in beautiful detail, a combination of bold strokes and beautiful, fine brushwork in the representation of these characters who are sort of, you know, just so appallingly and memorably isolated, lonely. Look at all the lovely people. Look at all the lovely people.
Eleanor Rigby, the choice of Paul Muldoon, who's with me in studio tonight. I mean, I know, Paul, you've worked with all sorts of musicians over the years, and, you know, you would have met a lot of people who might have been heroes to you over the years, and, you know, with Pen America and all the rest of it. And I've seen, I saw a photograph once, there was a bunch of people in it, yourself and Chuck Berry and Elvis Costello and all sorts of people in the same picture. I think Keith Richards might even have been in the picture. But anyway, I also saw he was, what do you call him, your man from Aerosmith. That was that one threw me. Steve Tyler.
But what
I'm leading up to is, despite that, and I say this because of my own professional experience running into some people like McCartney, there must be a part of you, the teenager from Armagh, who's going, what am I doing in a room with Paul McCartney?
Totally, of course. Absolutely. That's right. And it's just, I feel very lucky to have been able, but it's not, you know, I don't want to be sort of ticking off names or anything, but, you know, it's been lovely, very thrilling, really, for me to have met some of my heroes. I mean, two come to mind. Leonard Cohen, whom I didn't know well, but whom I really liked a great deal and whom I miss a great deal. He was just an extraordinarily beautiful person, as I think comes across, you know, from any, even, you know, footage of him. And you can see, actually, that, you know, see him interviewed, you can see what a beautiful person he is. And, you know, Paul Simon, whom I see a bit and whom I adore, and I think is really a genius, you know. I mean, when it comes to songwriting, he's kind of way out in his own there.
Of course, the thing about the two people you mentioned, Leonard Cohen and Paul Simon, is, well, Leonard would be known as a poet. People don't normally call Paul Simon a poet, but he's certainly extremely interested in poetry and knows his stuff. They, you know, they'd be more interested in the poet, and they're thinking, God, I wish I could do what poets can do.
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, Paul Simon, for example, is a big fan of someone we've mentioned earlier on, and that is Philip Larkin. Mm. And you wouldn't quite put that together, though. When you say, you know, the minute one says it, you say, okay, yeah, fair enough. But, you know, there are so many, and another of my real heroes, whom I've had, again, the pleasure of meeting, is Van Morrison.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's an album called The Best of Van Morrison. It's from a few years ago, and he's written fabulous stuff since then. And there is not a dud on it.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a very, very interesting writer. And, I mean, of course, having spent so many years in Belfast, I lived in Belfast between 1969.
You lived as I did on Fitzroy Avenue.
On Fitzroy Avenue. Yeah. I was by it the other day. I lived in a house on Fitzroy Avenue where we had a public health notice served on us. There were, you know, it was what we call student accommodation, i.e. a slum. And we had, I mean, this was nobody's fault but our own, of course, because we contributed to it mightily. We had, I think, about 150 milk bottles on the kitchen floor. And they were fantastic array of kind of day glow hues of green and blue. It was absolutely horrifying. But in any case, you know, what a fabulous facility Van Morrison has. I don't mean to use the word facility in any facile way, but I mean, he has a gift for presenting, you know, these powerful images. And
as a writer, Paul, did he know what he was doing back then when he wrote Astral Weeks? I mean, how much of that do you think was, as he would say himself, unconscious? Or is that even possible?
Well, I'm one of these people, however crazy it might sound, I hope it doesn't sound too crazy, who believes that the less conscious one is, the better.
Mm.
I mean, the more conscious one is in the business of art making, to give it a fancy title, probably the less interesting it's going to be.
Yeah.
To make interesting art, from what I can see, you have to go to the place where you really, in essence, don't know what you're doing. You know, of course, you need to, you know something. I mean, I was talking earlier on about knowing a lot at one point about, you know, poetry and 20th century poetry. Mm. Right. Sure, that's very important. But then you, at some level, actually, it's of no use to you.
Yeah.
And you have to go somewhere where no one has actually ever been.
Yeah.
And the way to get there is to be innocent and ignorant. And so if Van says he doesn't know what he was doing, I mean, that's a good thing.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so good. That's why the songs are so good. It's because he doesn't know what he's doing.
But it also makes things unrepeatable, doesn't it? You know, you get there once and it's very hard to do it again, because the next time around you are conscious.
Well, it's one of the reasons why it gets harder and harder to do any of these things at all as one gets older. Or it's not even so much gets older as one, the more one has done, paradoxically, the more difficult it is.
Yeah.
You know, for various reasons. You don't want to be repeating yourself. I mean, Van, I was saying, you know, is still writing very good songs. And he's rare enough in that regard.
Madam George from Van Morrison, the choice of Paul Muldoon, who's with me in studio tonight. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back. And this is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM. We're here until 9 o'clock, the Sunday night special, where we get someone in to pick the music. And tonight, I'm really happy to say it's Paul Muldoon, one of our greatest poets and much more. And Paul's picking all the music tonight. And we left off with Madame George in Fitzroy Avenue in Belfast, Paul. Those student days, one of the remarkable things, you were there 69 to 72, 73.
Yeah, at Queen's.
At Queen's. Mm-hmm. That's probably the worst time in Belfast history. And there you were in the university. The university, as I recall it, in the 1980s, which wasn't a good time either, it was a bit of a bubble nevertheless, you know, somewhat removed from what was going on in the rest of the city.
Well, to some extent, but I mean, yeah, I mean, they were not happy times, yeah. I think it's fair to say. I mean, they weren't. And 72, in particular, was, you know, just a horrifying time. The peak of the tit-for-tat killings, and you know, I'm a kind of timid soul, I'm sure, anyway, at the best of times, but you know, I certainly always was an element of fearfulness about the place, yeah. You know.
And did any of that, the awfulness going on around you, get in the way of the joy of, you know, learning about art and poetry and writing poetry and becoming a published poet at that period of time? You know, sometimes, I know, you know, Heaney has written about this too, about going into the BBC to record on the night something terrible had just happened, you know, himself and Hammond and somebody, and just deciding, well, we'll go ahead and do it anyway. We have to do it.
Well, you know, I mean, what can you do? I mean, the fact is, of course, that is going to be almost necessarily reflected in what one does. You know, sometimes overtly, sometimes less than overtly. I mean, for example, the first book I did, which came out in 1973, while I was still a student at Queen's, There's a poem in it. The last poem in it is called The Year of the Slows for Ishi. Ishi was the last member of a California tribe, Native Americans, who sort of appeared in the early 1900s and spent his life making arrowheads in the museum in Berkeley. I was there quite recently, actually, and I had the privilege of being allowed down into the bowels of the building to see some of the things he'd done. But in any case, though, it was dedicated to him partly because I was interested in a rather simple-minded way, possibly, of making connections between the Native Americans and some of the what we might call the predicament of, you know, some of the people in Ireland. It's a little crude, perhaps, and a little geometrical, but it seemed somehow appropriate. And indeed, in the overall shape of things, it's totally appropriate because there were methods that were developed in Ireland for the, put crudely, the putting down of the people that were carried across into the New World, and used in different places and different times to extirpate the local people. But in any case, this poem, though it purports to be, and it, to all intents and purposes, really seems predominantly to be about a tale drawn largely from a book called Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee by Dee Brown, which was very, very popular just at round about that time. It draws a lot of Native American imagery, symbolism perhaps even. But what the poem is really quote-unquote about is Bloody Sunday. Mm. Which was an event that, you know, at the time, I mean, seemed to have kind of huge ramifications and resonances. And now, however many decades later, I mean, is still something we haven't quite come to terms with, or, you know. Mm. So in any case, what am I trying to say? What I'm trying to say is that you know, what's happening in the world is going to find its way out into and out of art. And in many cases, I do belong to that crowd who believe that art actually does help us to understand what we're doing, and perhaps even why we do some things. And I'm certainly not going to say that the year of the slows is anything like the last word on Bloody Sunday. And I'm certainly not going to say that it's as direct a response to it as, say, Thomas Kinsler's 13 Dead. It's not. But, you know, I think at some level it might be part of the, in the midst of all the sociology and the history and the geography and the economics and the military history and all the rest of it, it might offer something.
Mm. You mentioned there about the capacity of art in those circumstances. Talk a little bit about poetry in particular, because it's very often the poetry that people seem to remember. Even people who say they don't know anything about poetry or not interested in poetry, and then the next thing they're quoting lines from an era.
Well, from an era.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I do think that we're talking about, there's a generational aspect to this.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm delighted to see, you know, that in this country, people are still reading poetry. They're still being examined in poetry. They're still you know, the Irish Times is commenting on the poets, mm-hmm. the poems that have come up in the Leaving Cert. You know, I mean, that, you know something? That's a fabulous thing to be able to say about a country. Mm-hmm. There's so many great things one could say about Ireland right now. And that's one of them.
Mm.
That they're actually discussing in the one of the national papers which poems are being are being presented. Yeah. I mean, you don't. Where do you get that? But let me tell you the answer to that.
Nowhere. Yeah. And yet, I still, you know, I kind of despair because poetry is obviously hugely powerful and hugely effective and means a lot to a lot of people, even though it means a lot even to people who don't realise it means anything to them. That's a strange twist in it.
Well, we're not exposed sufficiently to it. It should be even more normative. Mm. And yeah, I don't want to single out the Irish Times. Mm. The Irish Times should be running a poem every day.
Mm-hmm.
This lovely organisation, RTE, should be running a poem every day.
Yeah.
They really should.
Yeah.
It should be part of people's diet, you know, and one of the problems with it is that we look at it in the way that we look at. I've been travelling recently with my prospective son-in-law, as he's styled.
Sounds like you're checking this guy out, giving him the cone over.
One of the things I worry about is that he seems to be eating a lot of cricket bars.
Right.
You know, they're not. So they're selling crickets now in Sainsbury's and places like that, which is how it should be,
yeah.
And it's what we're all going to be eating shortly. But in any case, you know, on paper, you think, well, no, I don't want to do that. But actually, when you've had a cricket bar, you're thinking, that's okay. I'll do that again. And so
I'm not entirely sure where you're going with this.
Well, what I'm saying is exposure to cricket bars.
Right.
Is what is an important thing.
Okay.
You know.
Paul, your next musical choice I see is Horselips, and they are part of your extraordinary Muldoon's Picnic. And the idea of Muldoon's Picnic, it's yourself, band, and invited guests. You've got some extraordinary guests lined up, and your next choice, Horselips, are performing at the Everyman Theatre in Cork on the 5th of August. This is a lineup: Nick Laird, Zadie Smith, and Horselips. Not quite the Astoria Ballroom on a Friday night.
It's not?
Well, we didn't have Nick Laird and Zadie Smith. Paul, Horselips, I know you're friendly with the guys in the band and all the rest of it. When I was a teenager, they were hugely important. You know, talk about the Stones and the Beatles, they were the social phenomenon, really, because you could get to see them, which was one thing. But the fact they were Irish was kind of something extraordinary about a glam rock band with Tyrone accents in Barry's case. What did they mean to you?
Everything. I mean, you know, actually in the 1970s in Belfast, they were one of the few bands. There were a few bands that were willing to come into town, and they were one of them. I love what The Edge said about Horselips, which was that before Horselips, everything was in black and white.
Yeah.
And certainly they were a colourful crew. And they, you know, the energy was fabulous. And to see them, you know, coming on in the Whitla Hall in Belfast or the Ulster Hall or whatever, I mean, the joint was jumping. They were a fabulous band. And you know something? They're still a fabulous band. They're not fielding the entire force, of course. Alas, you know, we don't see so much of Charlie O'Connor or Eamon Carr, who are two fabulous members of the band. But the band that plays at the moment is remarkable. Johnny Fain, who was their main lead guitarist, you know, he was brilliant 40 years ago, and honestly, he's. I don't know if you've heard them. He's better now.
If there's any guitar player who wants to play a 20-minute long solo, I prefer it was Johnny Fain.
Totally.
You know?
So that'll be a night to remember with Sadie Smith, Nick Laird, and what do you call them? Horselips.
And that's Horselips, King of the Fairies, Paul Muldoon's choice. Paul's with me in studio tonight. He's doing these dates with Muldoon's Picnic. And I'll give you the dates now. He's at the Hawkswell Theatre in Sligo on Friday the 2nd of August. And on stage that night, Noolan the Gonal, Wendy Erskine, Len Graham and Duke Special. That's an extraordinary lineup. Yeah. Then we have at the Gate Theatre in Dublin, Sunday the 4th of August, Michael Longley, Anne Enright, Martin Hayes, Glenn Hansard and Lisa Lamb. I tell you, Paul, you're pulling together some great people. Everyman Theatre, Cork, Monday the 5th of August, Nick Laird, Zadie Smith and Horselips. The Glore Centre in Ennis, Wednesday the 7th of August, Declan O'Rourke, John Sheehan, Felisa Alusanya and Fintan O'Toole. What's Fintan going to be singing?
Fintan is going to be singing a ballad that I've written for him.
Very good. The Dock in Carrick on Friday the 9th of August, Stephen Sexton, Lisa O'Neill and Sinead Gleeson, and then the Mac in Belfast on Sunday the 11th, Moya Brennan, Cormac DeBarra, Leanne Sullivan and John Banville on banjo. Terrific. That's a great lineup, Paul, and that's Muldoon's Picnic, the tour dates. We'll put those on the website as well so you get a better idea of those.
Thank you so much.
Do you enjoy that, Paul, that whole... Because in a sense, this is you as a kind of a producer in a way and a P.T. Barnum or something all rolled into one.
You know, I don't know what's wrong with me, but I do enjoy it.
Yeah.
I do enjoy it. I mean... You know, I think it goes back to what we might have been touching on earlier, which is that I really believe that poetry and music and connecting with people and connecting people to them and the things that happen when, you know, the unexpected thing, because it's all, you never know what's going to happen in these shows. I mean, yeah, you know, you take various components, one takes various components and sets them down. But one never really knows what's going to happen, you know, and one can do a little, you know, perhaps a little arranged marriages. I mean, it's conceivable that you know, Martin Hayes might do something with Glenn Hansard or Lisa Lamb. You know, you just don't know maybe what form things might take. But there's a thrilling aspect of having such... you know, top-notch artists all in one place. Yeah. I mean, any one of them. Yeah. I could listen to any one of these people, poets and commentators and prose fiction writers, singers, and musicians. I could listen to any of them. I mean, John Sheehan there, of course, is the kind of the one surviving Dubliner that we were raving about earlier. I mean, I could listen to him all night. So the fact is that, the variety in these shows, and they are variety shows.
Yeah.
I mean, when I was a kid, and I think it might even still be going, some version of it, Sunday Night at the London Palladium was the show we watched. When I was a kid also, and more than a kid, my favourite hour and a half in the week was Sunday morning on Radio Éireann.
Yeah.
With Micheálú, with Ciarán MacMahona, and Sunday Miscellany. And the combination of words and music, there's nothing new about this.
Yeah.
This has been going on, and it was going on before RTE. You know, this is what was happening when Homer was running around. And this is what was happening when the Irish bards were in business in the palaces and the big houses. You know, this is what was happening, and it's a and we love it.
Your next choice, Paul. I notice you've got some handle here. Classical music, was that part of your world?
You know what? I have to say that it's an area in which I'm really not educated. That's what I was saying about the poetry earlier on. I just wasn't exposed to it, simply not exposed to it. And I regret that very much. I live in New York and I go to maybe 6 or 8 operas a year at the Met, which is an extraordinary opera house. And, you know, I'm not an expert in it. In fact, I have no idea what's going on most of the time.
Yeah, but you've written, libretti?
I have, yes, that's right. But I mean, you know, I mean, I'm tempted to say, yeah, but I mean, like, again, I have no idea what I'm doing, you know. I really don't. I'm just interested in various things.
Yeah. But saying yes seems important. This is a common thread through many of our guests, and I've put this to a lot of them. They often get asked to do things that are, in some sense, outside their bailiwick. Can you write a libretto for an opera? And they say, yeah. They don't know what it is, but they go ahead and do it anyway. So, you know.
Having a go, I think, is very important. Having a go is super important. This particular piece comes from, it was used, it's Handel's Sarabande that was used in Barry Lyndon. And it's just one of the most stirring pieces of music in one of the great films.
My babe lies cold within my arms, and none will let me in.
And that's Lisa O'Neill, who was a guest on this programme some months ago, picking the music. Tonight, she was picked herself by Paul Muldoon, a version of The Lass of Ockram. And before that, Handel's Sarabande from the movie Barry Lyndon. Paul Muldoon is with me in studio tonight, picking all the music. Paul, you just mentioned this in passing earlier on. First book of poetry came out when you were at Queen's, still at university. And a lot of people listening tonight might be writing or starting to write or so on. So I'll be interested a little bit in that trajectory and how it became your life as such. And I know it's not a simple, none of these things are simple, but was that a good thing or a bad thing to be a published poet while you're still, in a sense, a student poet? Because there would have been others, I'm sure, around you who were also writing poems and getting the odd one published here and there. Maybe many of them fell away, I don't know.
You know what? I honestly don't know. I mean, there are arguments for and against it, you know. I mean, one has to start somewhere. Oh, well, it doesn't have to start at all. But if one starts, you know, you start somewhere. And, you know, I know some writers who have not been so lucky, if luck is what we're talking about, as I have. I've had to wait a long time to get a book published. Yeah. And they're sort of, they keep working on the first book. Yeah. if it doesn't come out, it's hard. I think a lot of this is actually putting stuff behind you, yeah, getting rid of stuff, yeah, and moving on and trying to do whatever might be next, if anything. I mean, you know...
When you look at that first book, though, now, Paul, and do you recognise that young fella, as you were, you know, a student at that point, and you wonder, you know, what kind of... I'm thinking of myself, my own colleagues at university, how much emotional intelligence we would have had at that age, how wise we would have been. Not at all, you know?
No, I wasn't at all wise, but you know what? I don't know how to break this to you, John, but I continue to be not at all wise. I mean, I honestly know nothing about anything. I know nothing about... I mean, look at the world we're living in. I mean, who knows what's going on? I mean, it's just... It's completely crazy. And it's very hard for us to find ways of, you know, getting a path through it. So, but on the poetry front, you know, first of all, there's no advance in poetry. If anything, there's possibly a retreat or a diminishment, or, I mean, that suggests there might have been something there in the first place. You know, everybody is on the same, everybody's a starter, to go back to the word you use. Mm-hmm. Everybody is a starter, if they're lucky, mm-hmm, in the poetry business. I mean, that's the truth of the matter. And anyone who believes anything else is really misguided. Mm. And people who think they know what they're doing in, say, the poetry business, and they think they know how to do it, you know, they probably actually don't.
And if you were writing poetry to that level, Paul, as a student, and, you know, to get it published and to get great things said about you by great people at that time, mm-hmm. What effect, if any, did that have on the studies? I mean, was your mind on other things or what?
Yeah, but I don't. My mind was on other things. I worked very hard for a couple of years at Queen's, and then I took up beer and snooker.
Right.
You know.
So it wasn't the poetry that was the distraction.
I don't know. There were other things going on, mind you. There were other distractions. So I certainly wasn't a student in any conventional sense, and I didn't do very well in my final exams. But you know. And in many ways, I wish I had. But on the other hand, I don't really go back there. You know, it is what it is, as they say in America.
Well, did you end up in the BBC as a way of avoiding an actual job? I mean, as the BBC. No, I know the BBC producer, that is a real job. But there was a sense around Belfast at the time, and I'm sure it was the same in UCD, that the dander across the road to RTE was some way of kind of just maintaining that kind of student-y kind of or post-student existence where you wouldn't have to work too hard.
Oh, I certainly didn't have that feeling. No, it was a big thing for me to get a job. It was a remarkable thing for me to get a job at all, actually. But it was a job I loved. Yeah. I loved the radio.
What sorts of programmes did you make?
Well, I did all kinds of things. I made documentaries, you know, about various aspects of the arts and not necessarily always about the arts. Magazine programmes, there were reviews of plays and exhibitions and films, book programs, features as they were known. I think we still use that term in RTE also. Those are programs which combine a narrator with a dramatized component and effects. So I spent a lot of time working with actors and you know, some of the wonderful actors and people of, you know, lots of very interesting people. Patrick McGee, for example, who was in Barry Lyndon there. I worked with him just as he'd come off that. And
and was this all good for the poetry and the writing, or were you finding it an obstruction or getting in the way of it? Or?
You know, it's all one activity.
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned, if anything, to learn to, you know, one of the things we have to do on radio, and we're doing it right now, is to make sense and to be immediate and to be clear. One has to be clear. And I spent a lot of my years in the BBC, 13 years, writing scripts that said things like, and next coming up, we have Warren Zevon with Excitable Boy.
I see what you did there. Warren Zevon, Excitable Boy, the choice of Paul Muldoon. And Paul, I suppose a word about Warren. You've written songs with lots of people, and Paul Brady and others, but the first time I heard of you doing this lark was with Warren Zevon, who became a good pal.
Well, yes. I mean, I was a fan of Warren Zevon from the minute I heard that song, which would have been sometime, the early 70s. Is that right? I think it is.
Not sure when that one was.
And it was a bit later. Can't remember now. But in any case, you know, he was, as that song attests, he was an amazing songwriter. He was a very literary person, for what it's worth, which is not necessarily anything at all, because songwriting and, you know, the literary are connected, but there are great songs that have almost no literary quality at all. But he happened to combine the two.
Yeah.
And I did write a couple of songs with him. And One of them was called McGillicuddy's Reeks.
Yeah, yeah.
People who live in that area will be thrilled to hear that, I'm sure. And he was interested in McGillicuddy's Reeks for no reason. He'd actually read, I'd written a poem in, somewhere in which I mentioned McGillicuddy's Reeks, and he just was fascinated by the sound of it. Yeah. He really didn't know or care what it meant in that case. And then I wrote a song with him called My Rides Here, which was a fabulous, it was a lot of fun and a great learning experience for me. And, you know, I'd like to think that I learned something from him insofar as one ever does, you know.
And my understanding is you this began with you literally just dropping him a line and saying, I like what you do.
Absolutely. I wrote to him and said, you know, whenever I, for what it's worth, when I, you know, when I'm talking to people about songwriters, you know, your name is up there and I love what you do, and, you know, no need to respond to this or anything. I write fan letters.
Yeah, it's a nice thing to do, isn't it?
You know, I think it is. Yeah. I mean, I think it is. The first fan letter I wrote to was to Richard Green.
Robin Hood.
Robin Hood. And I wrote to him. It was a slightly self-serving fan letter, I have to say, because I wrote to him asking him if he had any spare bows and arrows, which he didn't. But he sent me his autographed photograph. But in any case, I think fan letters are great.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think there'd be something wrong with you if you didn't. And if you didn't, it's nice to think that somebody, you know, has heard something that you've done or has mm-hmm. read it, and you know, and maybe might even like it. That's a lot.
Your next choice, Paul?
You know, I have been a fan of U2 since actually quite early days. I was aware of their The Unforgettable Fire was the first album of theirs I bought, I think. But I'd heard some of the earlier pieces too, so the earlier albums, couple of albums. And of course, I remember vividly teaching at the University of East Anglia, and I'm sure like many's a one at the time, when it came out, played the Joshua Tree, on repeat. I just played it at full blast again and again. I think the neighbours were, there were complaints definitely from the neighbours. And I love what they do and what they continue to do.
Mm-hmm.
But the song I'll take here is a slightly unlikely one, but it's one in which they combine something I myself am particularly interested in and have a stab at doing myself, which is a kind of rappy sort of voiceover spoken word thing. And it features, rather than Bono in this case, though he's there in the background, it features at the Edge, and it's a song I love, Numb.
And that's Numb from U2. Paul Muldoon with me in studio tonight, picking all the music. Paul's here with his Muldoon's Picnic, and I gave the dates out earlier, and we'll put them all up on the website. So check out those dates in Sligo, Dublin, Cork, Ennis, Carrick and Belfast, with a really extraordinary lineup of guests as well, Muldoon's Picnic. Paul, I've seen more of you now in recent years, although you've been coming and going all the time, but when you went to America, did you go to America because, you know, there was a job there, or there was the poetry brought you there, or the success of the poetry brought, or did you actually emigrate?
Somebody asked me if I would go and teach in Columbia, and somebody coincidentally asked me if I'd go and teach at Princeton.
Yeah.
And I said yes. And, you know, it was for a semester, basically, or a semester or two, and it just sort of you know, 30 years later or more, you know, I'm still sort of there. In fact, I was mostly at Princeton, of course. That's my main job, which I love. But that's what I've done. I mean, I've stayed there. I'm married, and I have a couple of kids.
Well saved.
But all of those with the same woman, as it turns out. And I have a couple of kids who are the same kids, actually, too.
Now, another place where people can find you, and I recommend this, is, although you no longer present it yourself, but the New Yorker Poetry Podcast is a terrific listen. It's now done by Kevin Young, but all the ones that you did are also still available to listen to. That's something really worth checking out. Funny enough, I thought the most interesting one of all was with the fact checker.
Yeah,
the poetry fact checker.
That was a great one.
Have you ever had your poetry fact checked?
Totally. Absolutely. And I look for it's fact checked all the time.
Yeah.
You know, that's what copy editors do. And you know what? It's a great thing because it's very easy, at least for me it is, very easy just to go the wrong way, the wrong reading, the wrong spelling. So fact-checking is a good thing.
That's a really interesting programme, though, and I thought, you know, I wanted to hear a poet, but she was fascinating.
You know what? One of the things I tried to do, and I'm sure Kevin Young, who's now the poetry editor of The New Yorker, tries to do, is we've touched on this a little bit tonight. There is an educational aspect to this, you know. We have to learn how to read poems. We hate to believe that, but it's the truth.
Yeah.
We have to learn how to read poems just as we've learned for so many years how to listen to songs. And there's no shame in that. It's something we have to learn to do, like driving a car. And then it comes naturally to
us. I think that New Yorker Poetry Podcast is one of the most effective positive things about poetry that there is. I think it's great.
Well, that's what I definitely set out to do, was to provide a kind of, you know, an education for myself first.
Well, for anybody who's listening, because you get into a lot of ideas very quickly.
I educate myself, and I hope that someone will overhear, as it were.
And on a final question, Paul, you know, you mentioned earlier the state of the world, nobody can make head nor tail of it, which is absolutely true. The idea of a poet being a kind of a public figure, you know, God knows we all miss Seamus for those words of wisdom at appropriate times and so on. That idea that a poet might be even more necessary than ever in these times, is there anything in that?
You know, over the years, Seamus Heaney, of course, in this country did, as you say, take that role and did it rather splendidly. You know, I, like many as another one, I think, and perhaps even himself, would shy away from that. Mm-hmm. I think at some level, I don't know if it was necessarily what Seamus wanted to be doing mm-hmm. all the time. He was very good at it, but I don't really know if it's what he wanted. Having said that, I don't know if choice is open to any of us. And I think there are certain things that, you know, we just have to stand up and be counted in. Thinking of Lelia Doolin's great book from years ago. I mean, you do have to stand up as a citizen and then by extension, I think, as a writer. But in a strange way, I think it's primarily as a citizen.
Paul Muldoon, thanks a million for coming in tonight. Thanks for making all these very fine musical choices for us. And you want to finish with Paul Simon?
You know, I would hate ever to finish with Paul Simon, but we'll end with him. No, I love Paul Simon, as I suggested earlier. I think he's one of the great songwriters of this or any era. And
this is a recent song, though, and in many ways, I thought when I heard it first, it was kind of throwaway. But then, you know,
it's a good song, and it's a song he's on record. I mean, I don't want to be self-aggrandizing here, but I had a little part in it that we discussed it as he was working on it. And not that he needs or gets any help from me, but I did encourage him. He was wondering about whether or not he should continue with it. And I did encourage him to, you know, just to take that idea of the wristband and see where it would go and the various manifestations it might have, and needless to say, he did a rather fabulous job with it.
Paul, thanks a million.
pleasure.
Outside the backstage door to breathe some nicotine and maybe check my mailbox.
You've been listening to a podcast of Mystery Train with John Kelly. Mystery Train hits the rails every Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on 96 to 99 RTE Lyric FM.